She felt a rhythm without sound or movement, a sense of beating tension, as if the wheels of the John Galt line were still speeding on. Slowly, in answer, and in resistance to an unspoken summons, she turned and looked at him. The look she saw on his face made her know for the first time that she had known this would be the end of the journey. That look was not as men are taught to represent it. It was not a matter of loose muscles, hanging lips, and mindless hunger. The lines of his face were pulled tight, giving it a peculiar purity, a sharp precision of form, making it clean and young. His mouth was taut, the lips faintly drawn inward, stressing the outline of its shape. Only his eyes were blurred, their lower lids swollen and raised, their glance intent with that which resembled hatred and pain. The shock became numbness spreading through her body. She felt a tight pressure in her throat and in her stomach. She was conscious of nothing but a silent convulsion that made her unable to breathe. But what she felt, without words for it, was, "Yes, Hank, yes, now, because it is part of the same battle in some way that I can't name, because it is our being against theirs, our great capacity for which they torture us, the capacity of happiness. Now, like this, without words or questions, because we want it." It was like an act of hatred, like the cutting blow of a lash encircling her body. She felt his arms around her. She felt her legs pulled forward against him and her chest bent back under the pressure of his mouth on hers. Her hand moved from his shoulders to his waist, to his legs, releasing the unconfessed desire of her every meeting with him. When she tore her mouth away from him, she was laughing soundlessly in triumph, as if saying, "Hank Reardon, the austere, unapproachable Hank Reardon of the monk-like office, the business conferences, the harsh bargains. Do you remember them now? I'm thinking of it, for the pleasure of knowing that I've brought you to this." He was not smiling. His face was tight. It was the face of an enemy. He jerked her head and caught her mouth again, as if he were inflicting a wound. She felt him trembling, and she thought that this was the kind of cry she had wanted to tear from him, this surrender through the shreds of his tortured resistance. Yet she knew at the same time that the triumph was his, that her laughter was her tribute to him, that her defiance was submission, that the purpose of all of her violent strength was only to make his victory the greater. He was holding her body against his, as if stressing his wish to let her know that she was now only a tool for the satisfaction of his desire. And his victory, she knew, was her wish to let him reduce her to that. "Whatever I am," she thought, "whatever pride of person I may hold, the pride of my courage, of my work, of my mind, and my freedom, that is what I offer you for the pleasure of your body. That is what I want you to use in your service. And that you want it to serve you is the greatest reward I can have." There were lights burning in the two rooms behind them. He took her wrist and threw her inside his room, making the gesture tell her that he needed no sign of consent or resistance. He locked the door, watching her face. Standing straight, holding his glance, she extended her arm to the lamp on the table and turned out the light. He approached. He turned the light on again, with a single contemptuous jerk of his wrist. She saw him smile for the first time, a slow, mocking, sensual smile that stressed the purpose of his action. He was holding her half-stretched across the bed, he was tearing her clothes off, while her face was pressed against him, her mouth moving down the line of his neck, down his shoulder. She knew that every gesture of her desire for him struck him like a blow, that there was some shudder of incredulous anger within him, yet that no gesture would satisfy his greed for every evidence of her desire. He stood looking down at her naked body. He leaned over. She heard his voice. It was more a statement of contemptuous triumph than a question. "You want it?" Her answer was more a gasp than a word. Her eyes closed, her mouth open. "Yes." She knew that what she felt with the skin of her arms was the cloth of his shirt. She knew that the lips she felt on her mouth were his. But in the rest of her there was no distinction between his being and her own, as there was no division between body and spirit. Through all the steps of the years behind them, the steps down a course chosen in the courage of a single loyalty, their love of existence, chosen in the knowledge that nothing will be given, that one must make one's own desire and every shape of its fulfillment. Through the steps of shaping metal, rails, and motors, they had moved by the power of the thought that one remakes the earth for one's enjoyment, that man's spirit gives meaning to insentient matter by molding it to serve one's chosen goal. The course led them to the moment when, in answer to the highest of one's values, in an admiration not to be expressed by any other form of tribute, one's spirit makes one's body become the tribute, recasting it as proof, as sanction, as reward into a single sensation of such intensity of joy that no other sanction of one's existence is necessary. He heard the moan of her breath. She felt the shudder of his body in the same instant. Chapter 9. The Sacred and the Profane. She looked at the glowing bands on the skin of her arm, spaced like bracelets from her wrist to her shoulder. They were strips of sunlight from the Venetian blinds on the window of an unfamiliar room. She saw a bruise above her elbow, with dark beads that had been blood. Her arm lay on the blanket that covered her body. She was aware of her legs and hips, but the rest of her body was only a sense of lightness, as if it were stretched restfully across the air in a place that looked like a cage made of sun rays. Turning to look at him, she thought, from his aloofness, from his manner of glass-enclosed formality, from his pride in never being made to feel anything, to this, to Hank Reardon in bed beside her after hours of a violence which they could not name now, not in words or in daylight, but which was in their eyes as they looked at each other, which they wanted to name, to stress, to throw at each other's face. He saw the face of a young girl, her lips suggesting a smile, as if her natural state of relaxation were a state of radiance, a lock of hair falling across her cheek to the curve of a naked shoulder, her eyes looking at him, as if she were ready to accept anything he might wish to say, as she had been ready to accept anything he had wished to do. He reached over and moved the lock of hair from her cheek, cautiously, as if it were fragile. He held it back with his fingertips and looked at her face. Then his fingers closed suddenly in her hair, and he raised the lock to his lips. The way he pressed his mouth to it was tenderness, but the way his fingers held it was despair. He dropped back on the pillow and lay still, his eyes closed. His face seemed young, at peace. Seeing it for a moment without the reins of tension, she realized suddenly the extent of the unhappiness he had borne. "But it's past now," she thought. "It's over." He got up, not looking at her. His face was blank and closed again. He picked up his clothes from the floor and proceeded to dress, standing in the middle of the room, half turned away from her. He acted not as if she wasn't present, but as if it did not matter that she was. His movements, as he buttoned his shirt, as he buckled the belt of his slacks, had the rapid precision of performing a duty. She lay back on the pillow watching him, enjoying the sight of his figure in motion. She liked the gray slacks and shirt, the expert mechanic of the John Galt line, she thought, in the stripes of sunlight and shadow, like a convict behind bars. But they were not bars any longer. They were the cracks of a wall which the John Galt line had broken, the advance notice of what awaited them outside, beyond the Venetian blinds. She thought of the trip back on the new rail with the first train from Wyatt Junction, the trip back to her office in the Taggart Building, and to all the things now open for her to win. But she was free to let it wait. She did not want to think of it. She was thinking of the first touch of his mouth on hers. She was free to feel it, to hold a moment when nothing else was of any concern. She smiled defiantly at the strips of sky beyond the blinds. "I want you to know this." He stood by the bed, dressed, looking down at her. His voice had pronounced it evenly, with great clarity and no inflection. She looked up at him obediently. He said, "What I feel for you is contempt, but it's nothing compared to the contempt I feel for myself. I don't love you. I've never loved anyone. I wanted you from the first moment I saw you. I wanted you as one wants a whore, for the same reasons and purpose. I spent 2 years damning myself because I thought you were above a desire of this kind. You're not. You're as vile an animal as I am. I should loathe my discovering it. I don't. Yesterday I would have killed anyone who'd tell me that you were capable of doing what I've had you do. Today I would give my life not to let it be otherwise, not to have you be anything but the bitch you are. All the greatness that I saw in you, I would not take it in exchange for the obscenity of your talent at an animal's sensation of pleasure. We were two great beings, you and I, proud of our strength, weren't we? Well, this is all that's left of us. And I want no self-deception about it. He spoke slowly, as if lashing himself with his words. There was no sound of emotion in his voice, only the lifeless pull of effort. It was not the tone of a man's willingness to speak, but the ugly, tortured sound of duty. I held it as my honor that I would never need anyone. I need you. It had been my pride that I'd always acted on my convictions. I've given in to a desire which I despise. It is a desire that has reduced my mind, my will, my being, my power to exist into an abject dependence upon you. Not even upon the Dagny Taggart whom I admired, but upon your body, your hands, your mouth, and the few seconds of a convulsion of your muscles. I had never broken my word. Now I've broken an oath I gave for life. I had never committed an act that had to be hidden. Now I am to lie, to sneak, to hide. Whatever I wanted, I was free to proclaim it aloud and achieve it in the sight of the whole world. Now my only desire is one I loathe to name even to myself. But it is my only desire. I'm going to have you. I'd give up everything I own for it, the mills, the metal, the achievement of my whole life. I'm going to have you at the price of more than myself, at the price of my self-esteem, and I want you to know it. I want no pretense, no evasion, no silent indulgence, with the nature of our actions left unnamed. I want no pretense about love, value, loyalty, or respect. I want no shred of honor left to us to hide behind. I've never begged for mercy. I've chosen to do this, and I'll take all the consequences, including the full recognition of my choice, its depravity, and I accept it as such. And there is no height of virtue that I wouldn't give up for it. Now, if you wish to slap my face, go ahead. I wish you would.
She had listened, sitting up straight, holding the blanket clutched at her throat to cover her body. At first, he had seen her eyes growing dark with incredulous shock. Then it seemed to him that she was listening with greater attentiveness, but seeing more than his face, even though her eyes were fixed on his. She looked as if she were studying intently some revelation that had never confronted her before. He felt as if some ray of light were growing stronger on his face, because he saw its reflection on hers as she watched him. He saw the shock vanishing, then the wonder. He saw her face being smoothed into a strange serenity that seemed quiet and glittering at once. When he stopped, she burst out laughing. The shock to him was that he heard no anger in her laughter. She laughed simply, easily, in joyous amusement, in release, not as one laughs at the solution of a problem, but at the discovery that no problem had ever existed. She threw the blanket off with a stressed, deliberate sweep of her arm. She stood up. She saw her clothes on the floor and kicked them aside. She stood facing him naked. She said, "I want you, Hank. I'm much more of an animal than you think. I wanted you from the first moment I saw you, and the only thing I'm ashamed of is that I did not know it. I did not know why, for 2 years, the brightest moments I found were the ones in your office, where I could lift my head to look up at you. I did not know the nature of what I felt in your presence, nor the reason. I know it now. That is all I want, Hank. I want you in my bed. And you are free of me for all the rest of your time. There's nothing you'll have to pretend. Don't think of me. Don't feel. Don't care. I do not want your mind, your will, your being, or your soul. So long as it's to me that you will come for that lowest one of your desires. I'm an animal who wants nothing but that sensation of pleasure which you despise. But I want it from you. You'd give up any height of virtue for it, while I haven't any to give up. There's none I seek or wish to reach. I am so low that I would exchange the greatest sight of beauty in the world for the sight of your figure in the cab of a railroad engine. And seeing it, I would not be able to see it indifferently.
You don't have to fear that you're now dependent upon me. It's I who will depend on any whim of yours. You'll have me any time you wish, anywhere, on any terms. Did you call it the obscenity of my talent? It's such that it gives you a safer hold on me than on any other property you own. You may dispose of me as you please. I'm not afraid to admit it. I have nothing to protect from you and nothing to reserve. You think that this is a threat to your achievement, but it is not to mine. I will sit at my desk and work, and when the things around me get hard to bear, I will think that for my reward I will be in your bed that night. Did you call it depravity? I am much more depraved than you are. You hold it as your guilt, and I, as my pride. I'm more proud of it than of anything I've done, more proud than of building the line. If I'm asked to name my proudest attainment, I will say, I have slept with Hank Reardon. I had earned it. When he threw her down on the bed, their bodies met like the two sounds that broke against each other in the air of the room. The sound of his tortured moan and of her laughter. The rain was invisible in the darkness of the streets, but it hung like the sparkling fringe of a lampshade under the corner light. Fumbling in his pockets, James Taggart discovered that he had lost his handkerchief. He swore half aloud with resentful malice, as if the loss, the rain, and his head cold were someone's personal conspiracy against him. There was a thin gruel of mud on the pavements. He felt a gluey suction under his shoe soles and a chill slipping down past his collar. He did not want to walk or to stop. He had no place to go. Leaving his office after the meeting of the board of directors, he had realized suddenly that there were no other appointments, that he had a long evening ahead and no one to help him kill it. The front pages of the newspapers were screaming of the triumph of the John Galt line, as the radios had screamed it yesterday and all through the night. The name of Taggart Transcontinental was stretched in headlines across the continent, like its track, and he had smiled in answer to the congratulations. He had smiled, seated at the head of the long table at the board meeting, while the directors spoke about the soaring rise of the Taggart stock on the exchange, while they cautiously asked to see his written agreement with his sister, just in case, they said, and commented that it was fine. It was whole proof. There was no doubt but that she would have to turn the line over to Taggart Transcontinental at once. They spoke about their brilliant future and the debt of gratitude which the company owed to James Taggart. He had sat through the meeting, wishing it were over with, so that he could go home. Then he had stepped out into the street and realized that home was the one place where he dared not go tonight. He could not be alone, not in the next few hours. Yet there was nobody to call. He did not want to see people. He kept seeing the eyes of the men of the board when they spoke about his greatness, a sly, filmy look that held contempt for him, and more terrifyingly, for themselves. He walked, head down, a needle of rain pricking the skin of his neck once in a while. He looked away whenever he passed a newsstand. The papers seemed to shriek at him the name of the John Galt line, and another name which he did not want to hear, Ragnar Danishold. A ship bound for the People's State of Norway with an emergency gift cargo of machine tools had been seized by Ragnar Danishold last night. That story disturbed him in some personal manner which he could not explain. The feeling seemed to have some quality in common with the things he felt about the John Galt line. It's because he had a cold, he thought. He wouldn't feel this way if he didn't have a cold. A man couldn't be expected to be in top form when he had a cold. He couldn't help it. What did they expect him to do tonight, sing and dance? He snapped the question angrily at the unknown judges of his unwitnessed mood. He fumbled for his handkerchief again, cursed, and decided that he'd better stop somewhere to buy some paper tissues. Across the square of what had once been a busy neighborhood, he saw the lighted windows of a dime store, still open, hopefully, at this late hour. There's another one that will go out of business pretty soon, he thought as he crossed the square. The thought gave him pleasure. There were glaring lights inside, a few tired salesgirls among a spread of deserted counters, and the screaming of a phonograph record being played for a lone, listless customer in a corner. The music swallowed the sharp edges of Taggart's voice.
He asked for paper tissues, in a tone which implied that the salesgirl was responsible for his cold. The girl turned to the counter behind her, but turned back once to glance swiftly at his face. She took a packet, but stopped, hesitating, studying him with peculiar curiosity. "Are you James Taggart?" she asked.
"Yes," he snapped. "Why?"
"Oh!" She gasped like a child at a burst of firecrackers. She was looking at him with a glance which he had thought to be reserved only for movie stars.
"I saw your picture in the paper this morning, Mr. Taggart," she said very rapidly, a faint flush appearing on her face and vanishing. "It said what a great achievement it was, and how it was really you who had done it all, only you didn't want it to be known."
"Oh," said Taggart. He was smiling.
"You look just like your picture," she said in immense astonishment, and added, "Imagine you walking in here like this, in person."
"Shouldn't I?"
His tone was amused.
"I mean, everybody's talking about it. The whole country, and you're the man who did it, and here you are. I've never seen an important person before. I've never been so close to anything important. I mean, to any newspaper news."
He had never had the experience of seeing his presence give color to a place he entered. The girl looked as if she was not tired any longer, as if the dime store had become a scene of drama and wonder.
"Mr. Taggart, is it true what they said about you in the paper?"
"What did they say?"
"About your secret."
"What secret?"
"Well, they said that when everybody was fighting about your bridge, whether it would stand or not, you didn't argue with them. You just went ahead because you knew it would stand when nobody else was sure of it. So the line was a Taggart project, and you were the guiding spirit behind the scenes, but you kept it secret because you didn't care whether you got credit for it or not."
He had seen the mimeographed release of his public relations department.
"Yes," he said, "it's true."
The way she looked at him made him feel as if it were.
"It was wonderful of you, Mr. Taggart."
"Do you always remember what you read in the newspapers so well, in such detail?"
"Well, yes, I guess so. All the interesting things, the big things, I like to read about them. Nothing big ever happens to me."
She said it gaily, without self-pity. There was a young, determined brusqueness in her voice and movements. She had a head of reddish-brown curls, wide-set eyes, a few freckles on the bridge of an upturned nose. He thought that one would call her face attractive, if one ever noticed it. But there was no particular reason to notice it. It was a common little face, except for a look of alertness, of eager interest, a look that expected the world to contain an exciting secret behind every corner.
"Mr. Taggart, how does it feel to be a great man?"
"How does it feel to be a little girl?"
She laughed.
"Why, wonderful. Then you're better off than I am."
"Oh, how can you say such a—"
"Maybe you're lucky if you don't have anything to do with the big events in the newspapers." "Big? What do you call big, anyway?"
"Why, important."
"What's important?"
"You're the one who ought to tell me that, Mr. Taggart."
"Nothing's important."
She looked at him incredulously.
"You, of all people, saying that, tonight of all nights."
"I don't feel wonderful at all, if that's what you want to know. I've never felt less wonderful in my life."
He was astonished to see her studying his face with a look of concern such as no one had ever granted him.
"You're worn out, Mr. Taggart," she said earnestly. "Tell them to go to hell."
"Whom?"
"Whoever's getting you down. It isn't right."
"What isn't?"
"That you should feel this way. You've had a tough time, but you've licked them all, so you ought to enjoy yourself now. You've earned it."
"And how do you propose that I enjoy myself?"
"Oh, I don't know. But I thought you'd be having a celebration tonight, a party with all the big shots and champagne and things given to you like keys to cities, a real swank party like that, instead of walking around all by yourself shopping for paper handkerchiefs of all fool things."
"You give me those handkerchiefs before you forget them altogether," he said, handing her a dime. "And as to the swank party, did it occur to you that I might not want to see anybody tonight?"
She considered it earnestly.
"No," she said. "I hadn't thought of it. but I can see why you wouldn't.
Why? It was a question to which he had no answer.
Nobody's really good enough for you, Mr. Taggart, she answered very simply, not as flattery, but as a matter of fact.
Is that what you think?
I don't think I like people very much, Mr. Taggart. Not most of them.
I don't either. Not any of them.
I thought a man like you, you wouldn't know how mean they can be, and how they try to step on you and ride on your back if you let them. I thought the big men in the world could get away from them, and not have to be flea-bait all of the time. But maybe I was wrong.
What do you mean, flea-bait?
Oh, it's just something I tell myself when things get tough, that I've got to beat my way out to where I won't feel like I'm flea-bitten all the time by all kinds of lousiness. But maybe it's the same anywhere, only the fleas get bigger.
Much bigger.
She remained silent, as if considering something. It's funny, she said sadly to some thought of her own.
What's funny?
I read a book once where it said that great men are always unhappy, and the greater, the unhappier. It didn't make sense to me. But maybe it's true.
It's much truer than you think.
She looked away, her face disturbed.
Why do you worry so much about the great men? He asked. What are you, a hero worshipper of some kind?
She turned to look at him, and he saw the light of an inner smile, while her face remained solemnly grave. It was the most eloquently personal glance he had ever seen directed at himself, while she answered in a quiet, impersonal voice, Mr. Taggart, what else is there to look up to? A screeching sound, neither quite bell nor buzzer, rang out suddenly and went on ringing with nerve-grating insistence. She jerked her head as if awakening at the scream of an alarm clock, then sighed. That's closing time, Mr. Taggart, she said regretfully.
Go get your hat. I'll wait for you outside, he said.
She stared at him, as if among all of life's possibilities this was one she had never held as conceivable.
No kidding?
She whispered.
No kidding.
She whirled around and ran like a streak to the door of the employees' quarters, forgetting her counter, her duties, and all feminine concern about never showing eagerness in accepting a man's invitation. He stood looking after her for a moment, his eyes narrowed. He did not name to himself the nature of his own feeling. Never to identify his emotions was the only steadfast rule of his life. He merely felt it. And this particular feeling was pleasurable, which was the only identification he cared to know. But the feeling was the product of a thought he would not utter. He had often met girls of the lower classes who had put on a brash little act, pretending to look up to him, spilling crude flattery for an obvious purpose. He had neither liked nor resented them. He had found a bored amusement in their company, and he had granted them the status of his equals in a game he considered natural to both players involved. This girl was different. The unuttered words in his mind were, "The damn little fool means it." That he waited for her impatiently when he stood in the rain on the sidewalk, that she was the one person he needed tonight, did not disturb him or strike him as a contradiction. He did not name the nature of his need. The unnamed and the unuttered could not clash into a contradiction. When she came out, he noted the peculiar combination of her shyness and of her head held high. She wore an ugly raincoat, made worse by a gob of cheap jewelry on the lapel, and a small hat of plush flowers planted defiantly among her curls. Strangely, the lift of her head made the apparel seem attractive. It stressed how well she wore even the things she wore.
"Want to come to my place and have a drink with me?" he asked.
She nodded silently, solemnly, as if not trusting herself to find the right words of acceptance. Then she said, not looking at him, as if stating it to herself,
"You didn't want to see anybody tonight, but you want to see me."
He had never heard so solemn a tone of pride in anyone's voice. She was silent when she sat beside him in the taxicab. She looked up at the skyscrapers they passed. After a while, she said, I heard that things like this happened in New York, but I never thought they'd happen to me.
Where do you come from?
Buffalo.
Got any family?
She hesitated. I guess so. In Buffalo.